Welcome to the Digitally Sick podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Digitally Sick. It's a special episode. This time we have Dave Hunt, who is Chief Digital Officer at Havas Health, out in sunny California. I assume it's sunny, it normally is. And, you know, with me, I'm Alex Butler, as always, and also we have Faisal with us again today. Dave, good to speak to you.
Yeah, great to be here with you guys. Looking forward to the discussion.
So I've known you for quite a long time, and you've got a massive amount of experience. Do you want to kind of just give us a kind of brief synopsis of your, it's going to be lots of it here, but just, you know, a minute or so on you and what you've done?
I mean, I think you know where it started. The first thing I had to do was paint the office and used to get the sandwiches from Burger King and the fries from McDonald's and answer the phones when I first began at Creative Links. And fast forward 15 years, you're right, I'm lucky enough to be in LA. Over the course of that time, I've worked with brilliant people like yourself. You know, very proud of the work we did in social media. I've also, you know, helped to drive some firsts around closing marketing, CRM, use of data, launched emojis, and more recently, you know, drive digital therapeutics. So it's been incredible. I'm looking forward to, you know, sharing some of my ideas and some of my beliefs with you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, do you and Faisal, have you ever spoken to each other before?
I've known Dave for years as well. The last 10 years as well. It's taken 10 years to get him on the pod. That's how busy he is.
we're both fans of Smutia.
So basically today, we didn't want to be too prescriptive about what we talked about, because obviously there's so much that Dave could talk to about the work that he's done, thoughts he has, and the experience he has. And I know that, Dave, one of the big passions of yours is innovation in communications, rather than thinking of it as digital, which I wholeheartedly agree with. But looking back, I don't know, over the last 10 years, where do you think the state of play is with regard to how pharma's, you know, transformed itself through digital, transformed it the way it communicates with its customers, with people, patients, with the people that it wants to build relationships with? Where do you think we are, just to kick it off? Big question, but it will get us started.
So I think over the last 10 or 15 years, which is where I've been in this industry, there's been like pivot points when we could have taken a massive kind of leap forward. So, you know, early 2000s, there was a lot of talk around closed-loop marketing in its various different guises, and there was the tablet PCs, and we were all part of this thing where we went to all the different events and congresses, and we had all these ideas. It's like going to change the industry. And, you know, I was kind of disappointed that that wasn't necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we got lost a little bit in the technology and things like the experience and the ideas, you know, got lost a little bit in that. And then, you know, there was you and I working together in social. And again, you know, there was that inflection point of going, you know, we've made massive steps as we did together, and this is really going to galvanize the community and move forward. And I'm not sure the momentum was necessarily there after we did what we did. iPads, again, you know, going to transform the commercial model. And like a lot of people, kind of disappointed when a PDF made its way onto the device and we used about 3% of its capability. I'm going to try and avoid talking about the pandemic as much as I can with you guys over the course of this podcast, but it has to be the catalyst we're looking for to like change the industry. And one of the conversations I've been having with a lot of people in pharma is going, if not now, like when? If this isn't the reason to change what we're doing, what has to transpire to shift that movement? Mm-hmm. Now, what I've noticed a lot over the last sort of 6 to 9 months is there'd be like quite a lot of speculation of going, it's a revolution in our industry, it's a revolution in our industry. But what I think people are failing to do is say where it's going to. And I think it's that easy as a consultant to go, it's going to be a revolution. It's a lot harder to go, And this is the nature of that, and this is kind of how we get there. Mm. But the other thing that I've noticed, and I work with this coach, and he's a brilliant guy. He's called Kevin Taylor, and you're gonna find this crazy, but he's a hostage negotiator, and he now does like coaching. And what he does is he tries to put you in the shoes of the people you're talking to understand their position to move them forward. So people like us three, you know, we can see the future. And we know we want to like, you know, be disruptive for the greater good and drive forward ideas. But one of the things that I've reflected on over the past couple of months is it's easy for me to go on a Zoom or whatever and go, we need to do this. But it's also really important that we put ourselves in the shoes of the people we're trying to advise, who, you know, haven't seen a peer for like 6 months, who may or may not have concerns around security and what's taking up place. And you've got this crazy Mancunian going, we need to do this, we need to do the other. So for me, yes, we need to change how we do stuff, but we also have to take the people on this journey. And we have, you know, the responsibility to do that, to capitalize on the opportunity to transform our industry. But honestly, I genuinely believe the empathy for the people and the brand team we're working with is probably the most important thing to build their confidence, build their capabilities, and to drive change.
You know, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, the biggest thing, and I don't like being right about this because I don't feel like it's, first of all, it's pretty obvious in some ways to predict it, but also I don't like the fact that it was right. But my fear all along was that it was the philosophy that needed to change. And, you know, new technologies enabled us to do things differently, but actually it was the mindset that mattered. You mentioned the iPad. That's fine. You can show someone an iPad, but if you're not using it to connect to other peers or to give real-time, you know, kind of response with regard to how people think about medicine, for example, as in connected care, if you're just using it to put a PDF on, then what's the point? With social media, we were very excited, and I was very excited about it because I thought it's the first time that we could maybe dismantle systems and rebuild them with people, patients at the heart of it, but with pharma being able to put a human face and have a genuine, meaningful interaction with people. And I'm not saying that's never happened, but, you know, pharma is not any further on, really, with how it uses social media than it was probably 10 years ago, you know, maybe even a bit more, and certainly 10 years ago. And so and I was asked by Cambridge University in the UK a couple of years ago to put together a presentation for them on all of the ways that social has impacted health. And there was 50 massive ways that it had, including patient communities, patient, you know, kind of expertise, clinical trials, you know, there was so many different powerful things that it had done, a speed of publication of literature, being able to understand, you know, kind of behavior, blah, blah, I won't go on. Pharma doesn't really do a fraction of the things that it could do. So, yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's a change management transformation thing. And that thing you said about helping people to get there, often the most exciting things you can do in digital is to enable things to happen by making it comfortable for people to change. You know, and that's a big driver.
There was a brilliant, and I think it's so important today, but there was a brilliant study done in 2012, and it was looking at the importance of patient preference and patient preference to improve outcomes. And what it was really talking about was the education and the empowerment of patient preferences. And it was obviously based on Maslow's hierarchy, and it talks around like patient requirements, and it goes like information, communication. And then as it goes through, it starts to get into control, stability, and environment. And when I look at this, I go, as an industry, we've been really good at the first couple, but we get less good when we start to try and meet like the emotional needs of a patient. And I feel like this is the catalyst to be able for us to be able to do that. And there's some interesting points because everyone's raving about this kind of mass adoption of technology. And, you know, we've all been in meetings where, you know, you've got a great idea and someone goes, yeah, but you know, they don't use a website or they don't use a mobile phone or whatever. And it's really refreshing to be able to turn around and say, you know, my mum who's 75 is now proficient on Instagram. She doesn't stop WhatsApping me at all crazy hours of the night. I'm a little boy who's 7 is learning homeschooling. But the big thing, right, the big thing for me, it's not like the mass adoption of technology. It's the fact that people are better at using it. And suddenly what I think has been this massive step up in people's skills and expertise at using technology. And it now means that when you're in that meeting and you're discussing patient support, and unfortunately someone says, oh, you know, but they can't use a website, they can't use an app, that's no longer an acceptable excuse. And what I think has taken place is the roof has been blown off what we can actually achieve with patient support. And when I go back to this study around patient preferences and the emotional well-being of patients and how we can play a role in that, for me, it's probably the most exciting time in the industry because we can actually now fulfill the ambition we had.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Faisal, what are your thoughts?
No, I think, yeah, 100%. I think, when Dave mentioned, like, thinking about the empathy of the brand teams as well and taking them along that journey. I think that's really important. Never thought about that properly. Do you see what I mean? It's like, because we're all suffering at the moment. Do you see what I mean? We all need support and stuff. And I think some of the stuff we offer clients is pushing them out the comfort zone. And everyone's sort of outside their comfort zone at the moment. Do they need something else outside their comfort zone? So empathy is really important, I think, at the moment. And I think the excuse that patients don't use websites, mobiles, smartphones, they're too old to use a smartphone, that's amazing, because that's gone out the door. The other excuse we need to answer as well, and this is what we all get all the time as well, is, well, we can't do that because of the regulations, etc. So we just need to help people along that regulation journey as well, I think.
And on the regulations of the front, I mean, it's an interesting one, because I've always taken it sounds incredibly dull, but I've always taken a massive interest in ethics, for a start, regulation and regulatory requirements, and of course legal, and they're all different. And it's one of those things that if you aren't empowered as someone that wants to try and effect change, to understand those three things in great detail, certainly ethics is more of a philosophy, but you know, it's certainly regulatory and legal, then you're not in any fit state to enable change within an organization, because they have certain responsibilities which are very serious, you know, and you have to understand what those responsibilities are in order to enable someone to do something different.
Yeah.
There's always risk, and that's fine, because it's a risk balance. And I remember that, you know, days back in the day, a decade ago, when we did the first ever open disease community, so for psoriasis, which people still misunderstand 10 years later, there was a lot of risk involved in that. But the benefit that we thought it could get to patients by getting literally tens of thousands of patients to use tools to help themselves was deemed by everyone, including the legal team and the medical team and the regulatory compliance team, to be worth that risk. If we manage that risk properly, we do things in the right way. And that's never changed in that last 10 years in everything that I've done, which is that, you know, and whether that be pushing for really simple interfaces in digital health environments, for instance, to measure resistance in oncology, which was seen as not being supported by literature, but was supported by the ethics of helping people stay non-resistant to their medication, or whether it be enabling, you know, kind of whatever it is that we want to do in social, or whatever we want to do from a marketing perspective. Do you see, now being out in the States, Dave, I suppose it's a bit of a leading and obvious question, but do you see differences between the mindset, the philosophy, the state of transformation in the US to Europe, UK? Or how do you think they compare with each other?
So I see similarities and differences, and it's obviously a spectacularly leading question, so thank you for that. The one thing that I never really appreciated as much as I probably should have before I came to the US, and it sounds ridiculous, is just the scale of the market. Mm. You can say you do, and I certainly did have an appreciation for it, but it's when I'm physically living and breathing it every day that I get a sense of just this incredible size to it. And that's quite incredible, because it means the scale of your impact is equally big, you know, which is ace. But it also means that with that scale comes, you know, the need for absolute discipline and rigor around the decision making. And obviously it becomes, you know, a bigger process, but I kind of really appreciate that. But I see more similarities mm-hmm. than I see differences. And one of the things that, you know, I'm asked is, you know, okay, you've had a hand in some really different, great, good, whatever word you choose, campaigns, you know, what was it down to? And 9 times out of 10, I think it's down to people, right? So I think it's about having super talented people that you're working with who come up with great ideas, and that doesn't matter where you are in the world. And then I think you need super great clients. And again, that doesn't matter where you are in the world.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for people who, you know, want to drive change. And back to my earlier point, I think that's probably in everyone. It's just that with some people, you have to hold their hands and carry them through that process more than before. I've been working on a campaign for the last 8 weeks, and I'm so proud it's gone live. And in 8 weeks is an incredibly short time frame. And we began the process, and I'm on the phone to the clients. And it was when this thing like really resonated with me of going, I really need to take on board their position. And here I am chatting to them through Zoom, bouncing up and down, and you know, I want to change the world. And they're going, oh my God, but you know, I've got another 15 different projects to do. And like, I'm on the own, and I've not seen all these people. And understandably, there was an anxiety. The same people, like 8 weeks later, pinging me every day going, I've got another idea, I want to do this, I want to do the other. And that for me is the reason I love doing my job, actually, because I know they'll go on and they'll do better work. But if you were to say, you know, what do I think drove that transformation? I honestly believe, and there's an onus on all of us to do this, it's rolling up your sleeves, getting stuck in, and working with them on a day-to-day basis. And one of my absolute pet hates, is I hate pitching ideas that don't become a reality. Yeah. I just hate it. The thing that excites me is not winning work, it's not coming up with ideas, it's making them a reality. And if that involves, you know, rolling up your sleeves, writing a bit of code, well, I've not done that for 10 years, whatever it takes to make it a reality, because I know once it's a reality, it'll be a snowball for more stuff.
Sorry, I just think that's so, so true, the making it a reality, because, you know, you mentioned earlier conferences, expos, keynotes. There's so many people in the digital health, pharma space who are, in inverted commas, thought leader, which normally translates as somebody that hasn't actually ever done anything but likes talking about it a lot. And they're the people that are often to blame for us moving on to the next great thing, whether that be AI or whether it be something else, before we've actually properly implemented and made real the opportunities that we had from the last piece of jargon that they were talking about a couple of years ago.
That's the key point, and I just want to make that point. That jargon kills this industry.
Yeah.
That vocab that people use that makes them sound clever, that terrifies brand teams around the world, is actually the thing that's stifling innovation.
Yeah.
And if we just spoke in clear, simple language, maybe it helps because I'm from Manchester, but if we called a spade, people would be less confused and we could drive bigger change.
Yeah. So true. So an example of that the other day, sorry if I was going to come in, just get this while I remember it, at my age I forget, was talking about, oh, you know, an agency had sold in a chatbot or something. And they thought that the agency were actually going to code a chatbot. Of course, they didn't realize they're just going to get something off the shelf. And actually the clever bit of this in NLP and the machine learning behind it requires a log, and it requires a continuously learning algorithm, which means that in pharma, you're going to have to check that log. You're going to have to check it for AEs, you're going to have to check it for product complaints, you're going to have to check it for serious things of people asking maybe very serious questions, whatever, you get the point. And at no point at the agency flogging this chatbot, which was inappropriate anyway for what they were trying to do it for, it was in rare disease, and they could have called the patient that they had around the world rather than put a chatbot in place. But the point is, that's selling a technology to somebody that might, not through their fault, buy it without realizing the implications. It's not solving a problem. And, you know, that, and the jargon totally gets in the way because people tick boxes of things that they think sounds cool. Or, you know, that's actually being less charitable than I mean. They do things that they think is the right thing to do because it's the next thing and it's moving things on and it's changing things, but they're not maybe given the whole picture. Sorry, Fives, I cut across you. I didn't mean to do that.
No, I was just laughing at the jargon thing because, I mean, if deep down the jargon actually takes it a lot further because people have gone in, done the jargon, sold something, and it's never worked. It's had one user, etc. And then when you go in, try to sort of implement a proper solution, that's it. People are just a bit wary. They're after KPIs. They're after all the stats and stuff. And it's a long journey to get them to buy it and stuff. I was going to ask, though, sideways, but in the US, Dave, are they talking about more diversity this year as well? Obviously you've got COVID, and when people are talking about patient communications and doing things for patients, is there more word about diversity at the moment as well?
Now this is a tough question. So yeah, of course, 100%. And you know, I'm going to talk about it from an agency point of view in terms of the diversity, like within an agency, because I really, really, really believe that in order to deliver the best work, you have to have like an insight and an empathy. You know, so for example, when I was at Fast Links, very important to me was Matt Eagles, who was our head of patient engagement, and he brought so much to the team in terms of his point of view. And there's a real lack of diversity within healthcare and within agencies all around the world, which we all know and we want to address. And I think it's interesting because when I was less aware of it, say 10 years ago, you'd go and do a global pitch and you'd be like, you know, they'd just would all be English or would all be Americans. Like, well, this is crazy because you've not got that geographic footprint from around the world. I think we address this, by the way, by getting into the schools. So at the moment in California, before when I was in the UK, I do a lot trying to get into secondary schools and try and encourage greater diversity into the creative university courses, because I think if you can get greater diversity there, it will then filter through for the rest of the industry. But one of the things that I've done over the last 9 months, and I tell you, I absolutely love it to bits, is I've set up a new, for want of a better word, think of it as a digital product design lab, and it's called Now. And it's just incredibly diverse thinkers, and the idea is to try and solve problems in healthcare. And I love it to bits. The team is based all around the world. So we've got people in like Central Europe, people in UK, people in the East Coast, the West Coast, and in Asia. And we come together every single day for what me is 7:15 in the morning. So I'm having a cup of coffee. Someone in the UK is having a pint. And every single day we chat for like 45 minutes. And it's just incredible because I'm not talking about like necessarily like an ethnic diverse or anything else. These are people who live all around the world who are plugged into different cultures, different economic scenarios, different histories, different places. And we come together and you can have, you know, a user experience designer in Madrid working with an art director in LA. And I absolutely love the diversity in backgrounds and thinking and how it comes together. And the pandemic has made that happen. And honestly, it works as seamlessly as whatever I was used to, you know, in Manchester, and I love it to bits. So that's how I'm supporting and driving diversity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, nice.
Jumping all over the place a little bit, but at the moment working a lot in essentially helping to drive and deliver remote care. It sounds boring. You know, as a thought leader, you talk about digital health and the capacity of the self-management and the track and measure disease and, you know, kind of the improved quality of life and all that kind of stuff through, you know, mostly apps. But if you maybe think of this day because of the COVID thing, that the amount of discussion that absolutely went crazy around telehealth, telemedicine, but obviously it's interaction with digital health and mobile health care. The conversation went absolutely massive. Not surprised, you know, COVID suddenly meant that, you know, doctors couldn't see their patients again, whether that be in whatever disease area, chronic disease you think of, but obviously serious ones like MS, for instance, you know, it had a real problem. And one of the things that I think COVID has shown is a bit what I was trying to say earlier about how the boring things are often the most important. Because it's not that doctors weren't super excited about the capacity to measure disease better, to give better, more personalized support to people, to literally improve outcomes, whether they be patient type reported outcomes in quality of life or the actual clinical measures, like cognition or movement or whatever it might be. And it wasn't that patients didn't actually want to try these things, especially if they were done well and they were at the backing of the doctor. There was two things that got in the way. One was an integration between the diagnostic measurement and management services and basically healthcare providers, because what's the point in doing this being dislocated from your provider if it doesn't integrate with their system? If when you go in and say, I've been tracking this, the doctor says, okay, that's fine, but put that to one side and let's just tell me about, you know, what's happening. You know, it's not that synergy. And the second thing, and it's just as important, although boring, which is the capacity of the healthcare professionals to actually use this stuff to get reimbursed for it. For it to be able to be used with regard to their insurance, for it to be integrated into their workflows and processes. And I don't know, the older I get, the more I realize that actually the most exciting stuff is often, like I was saying, the enabling of the boring stuff to get done, because suddenly you had healthcare providers saying, yes, you can be reimbursed for doing this remotely. Yes, you can use this tool and service. Patients were suddenly encouraged by their healthcare professional to take up these services. And there's been a massive uptake in services that I don't think will disappear now, when, you know, if and when we all hope that we can get back to some kind of normality. I don't know I know you said you didn't want to talk about a pandemic, but I wonder what your experience is from your side of the pond, so to speak, with regard to, you know, in regards to that.
So I think in my career, I'm hoping the most worthwhile thing that I do, where I have the biggest impact on people's lives, is right here, right now, on telehealth.
Yeah.
I really believe there is a need for empathy, creativity, and support in this space. And it is my number one commitment to try and like help and support people through this. I think there are organizations, for example, Microsoft, who in the wake of the pandemic ran an advert about Teams and how brilliant it was for telehealth. And it was amazing. And he had a load of doctors saying, it's brilliant, brilliant. I cannot tell you how irresponsible I thought that was, right? Yeah, great. The technology's worked. Okay, so it's convenient and I can see them. But that is like only a very small component of a consultation with a clinician. And it is naive and ridiculous to suggest we're suddenly there at the solution. I don't know how many decades, hundreds of years, there's been consultations between, you know, someone who's sick and someone who has knowledge. And over the course of those hundreds of years, there's been the development of what we all refer to as like bedside manner. But even over the last 10 or 20 years, there is still that consultation that takes place in the clinic, whether it's good news, bad news, whether it's critical. And we've developed like expertise in how we sensitively handle that information and get the most out of it. To think that within 2 months we cracked that through virtual is utterly ridiculous. It's like conducting an interview via Zoom and going, that was as good as face-to-face. Of course it wasn't. Now, my commitment and my determination is to try and get as close as we can to the physical experience virtually in the minimum possible kind of time frame. And I think that needs creativity and imagination. I think it needs behavior change. I think it needs wider consideration of, you know, the different stakeholders and their role within this. But I just want to share with you like a couple of examples where there's a lot of extra thought required. So let's take the consultation. So you know what I mean? You're going to go see the doctor and, you know, I'm British, you know, maybe not me, but certainly a lot of people are stoic. They're stoic, right? So the doctor says, how are you feeling? And you turn around and you go, I feel fine. Now, clearly, you don't feel fine, but that's the disposition you give. How much easier is that to do via Zoom than face-to-face? You arrive at a clinic, you go in through the door, you walk in and see the GP, you sit down. There is so much more to the experience physically than there is virtually. It's so much easier to convince a clinician you're doing fine virtually than it may be like face-to-face. All those little clues that a doctor may have are suddenly missing. And it's one of those things we need to overcome. We've just done, and then flipping it to like the dissemination of information. We've just worked on some training for telehealth for patients and healthcare professionals. And I was chatting to a friend of mine in the development of this, and he was talking about having this telehealth visit, and he was talking about how they'd received information. And obviously, it's nowhere near as good as it can be. And one of the thoughts that came to us is just going like, you know, if you're going for an important consultation where you, for example, getting test results, could be good, could be bad, you know, make sure you're not in a house on your own. Make sure you're not on your own. And for me, like if 100 people get that message or 1,000 people get that message, then I think what we're doing is like really worthwhile. So one of the things that I'm determined to try and do over the next like 3, 6 months, 12 months is just do as much as I can to try and educate and support people around like telehealth consultation to try and get it as close as we can to the physical thing. Now, of course, you know, you're talking about reimbursement, key component, triaging, another key component. But I honestly believe there's a softer behavior change component, which means the virtual consultation can get closer to the physical.
I think, I mean, when we look at auditing, you know, systems, whether that just be a simple digital application or whether it be a whole virtual care, you know, the three components we look at is, you know, the clinical outcomes and the evidence base that you have and that you can create, the behavioural change that you're looking to intervene with and you're looking to support, and the experience, as in positive or negative, and therefore the value for the actual patient involved and also for the healthcare professional. When you look at trying to solve problems, often it's about augmentation of current practice, not replacement. But sometimes telehealth is absolutely essential. So, for instance, if you have a relatively rare neurological condition, say in Canada, you know, going to the hospital to get a checkup and to speak to your team is really important to you, but it's also a massive thing. You know, you might have to travel many, you know, many hundreds of miles and things, you know, it's a big experience. And I suppose the point is, it's when is it best for people to see each other face to face? When is it best for it not to be? But more important to your point, how do we know, knowing that the experience is different, it's not just a case of like get a camera in front of both people so they can talk to each other. How do we actually make that experience so that we know more about the patient is better able to express how they feel, we're better able to track and measure the impact that that consultation, but also the care is having on outcomes. And I think that's where it comes in. I mean, with MS, you know, you can now track, you know, kind of progression of disease alongside a whole load of different measures outside of the clinic. Doesn't mean to say you shouldn't have clinic visits, but what it does mean is that you might have a better, more ongoing relationship with your care team. And it can count for the behavioural, so you're not just measuring objective things within one clinic experience, you're measuring someone's entire emotional impact, their fatigue, and their, you know what I mean? And you can transpose that into any or most chronic diseases.
It's that interesting because I am desperate to not go, this is what we did physically, and therefore now let's just repurpose it virtually. Like, I'm desperate to not do that. I'm also keen not to be dismissive of things that actually could bring value. So we've all produced thousands of talk to doctor toolkits. And you know what? They're super valuable. They're really valuable, and they help us get more out of the consultation. And I loved an idea, you know, from a few years ago where you have like cards that describe symptoms. You know, so you've got like the burning fire, or you've got like the broken glass, or you've got the cloud for you know how you may be feeling. And it kind of struck me that that was something that we did for a world 5 or 10 years ago. But my gosh, that's super valuable in telemedicine. You know, suddenly being able to like pull up those cards when you've got this like now, like this technology barrier between you, maybe quite a nice way to kind of break the ice. But going back to what you and I did 10 years ago, and one of the great things I think in psoriasis was the articulation of symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a good thing. And I'm there going like, how incredible would it be if within telemedicine you could curate from the crowd descriptions of symptoms and give everyone access to the same vocab? So you've got someone who's like super eloquent, who can describe their symptoms brilliantly, and you've got someone else who may struggle. Now, if we can find a way to bring that kind of crowd language into a telehealth consultation, suddenly everyone can describe the symptoms equally. And we all know that allows better referrals, better treatments, better outcomes. So I think if we can take some of those old ideas and combine them with some new ideas, yeah, we can do something pretty great.
I think empathy is most important. Is it, you don't have to answer this, Dave, but have you seen any tech that supports this come out of California or where you are at the moment in Silicon Valley?
It's weird, yeah, because I arrived and there was a pandemic. So my ability to kind of get out and about and do, you know, what I would have liked to have done has been, you know, a little bit more limited than I would otherwise have liked. But, you know, hopefully, you know, the vaccine's coming and the pandemic's ending. And, you know, my intention here really is dead simple. It's to provide access to pharma with the best thinking in the world, yeah, from an innovation and technology point of view. And I fully intend to do that.
So flipping it on the other side, so we're talking about patients and HCPs and stuff. A lot of pharma companies are trying to work out the sales rep and what the sales rep does in the digital world, which is massively important because everyone's hasn't worked that out. They're thinking, let's just do a Zoom call. So there's that element to it as well. I don't know if you've done anything exciting in that area.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think, and I know you guys agree with this, there's certain things that are intellectually dead lazy and dead easy to jump on the back of. So for example, let's reduce the field force. Do you know what I mean? It's just, yeah, so easy for someone to say that, and it's going, but actually, is that the right thing? Or is it to build new capabilities and support them to operate in different ways? And actually, through that, drive more success. Now, one of the things, again, that I think is an opportunity we have moving forward, and we've all spoken about this for years, but now is the time we can really move it forward. And I have championed like this idea of like good pharma, one of a better word, and the idea of using creativity to improve outcomes, drive commercial success. and I've championed it from probably like 2011, 2012. Now, more than ever, I think we can do this. So for me, the old commercial model is dead. But by that, I'm really talking about the nature of the content and the messaging and what we're providing, which is very, very, very much geared around like pushing messages. Now, more than ever, I think what healthcare professionals are looking for are partners. I think they're probably more frustrated, more isolated,
yeah,
under more pressure than they've ever been before. And I'm not just talking about the pandemic. I'm talking about, you know, their existence in general is harder than it's ever been. And for me, the person who needs to provide that support or the organization is pharma. And I think now more than ever, we can provide like support, value, advocacy. And by doing that, actually shift to a commercial model which is geared around partnership. But in order to do that, it definitely requires a field force. I just think it requires like a different way of approaching it. And that's definitely what I'm trying to work on at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, my thought on this has always been that, first of all, in the early days of digital being implemented, it was very badly positioned as being somehow in competition with sales forces or more traditional ways of working. I never understood why that was done. Because it is completely not, I think, what it's for. And the second mistake I think you make, or people can make, is to misunderstand what it is that made good sales reps successful, and therefore what it is that they would be even replaced with. Because a good salesperson is not good because he reads through a detail, he or she, of course, absolutely most of you, reads through a detail aid to a doctor. And the doctor goes, oh, these differential marketing statements are really compelling, I'm now going to change my practice. They work because they build a personal relationship with that healthcare professional. They share information from, you know, around the geography, what other people are doing, best practice. They support their entire practice in the community, and they enable them to have other access to the pharma company that they maybe wouldn't know how to get or whatever. They help solve problems, and they personalize complex science in the sense of a doctor doesn't need science explained to them, but making it clinically relevant or making it easier for them to be able to do something different is hard. So I suppose my point is that was never going to be replaced by a self-directed e-detail. And the idea that someone would come home after a long clinic and want to take themselves through 15 slides of a self-directed e-detail rather than watch Netflix and have a glass of wine, I suppose it's take your pick. But do you know what I mean? I think sometimes if you misunderstand why something might work well in the first place, then you try to solve the wrong problem with the technology.
Yeah, it was a massive...
Sorry, go on.
No, sorry, I was just saying, it's just adding, it's a massive mishap. I sat teaching, launching iPads on detail aids on iPads, and the whole of the sales force said, you're going to track us, this is an HR issue. So it was totally missold. I think to Dave's point earlier as well, just adding the benefits and services and thinking about empathy, how we can get the sales force to work with the doctors as well. Another key thing is doctors are quite suicidal and they're so stressed as well. There's a massive report we did a few years ago, and I think my previous company, we launched, took a few years, but we launched something with Sermo on supporting doctors who are suicidal and stuff. There's that element to it as well, and supporting them. Thinking about behavioural science as well is like they... When you do the day in a life exercise of someone, like if you're thinking about design thinking, how people spend their day, a lot of people that come back doing those exercises internally and saying, right, they're going to check a trade journal at 11 o'clock, they're going to have a webinar with the pharma company, and they're going to read an email twice a day from a pharma company. That's not going to happen. Do you see what I mean? It's like rethinking that whole model and how we...
That's the use of a process, though,
yeah, totally.
That's mapping a person's journey.
Yeah, but that's where empathy comes in, is we need to think about empathy a lot more and using the sales force to support doctors with that empathy as well. It's like... Let's not push people to make sure they have 20 calls a day, or let's try to push them towards having more valuable calls or more time spent when the doctor is ready to spend time, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just...
Yeah, I mean, I think... No, I mean, there's a lot of good points there. And Alex, I totally agree with this juxtaposition between the field and digital, and like how badly contrived it was to be in competition versus like complementary. And I've been in loads of conversations where the field will be described as like, why gods, And I imagine that the field would be in loads of conversations going, digital has no idea about customer experience. And clearly both sides are wrong. And actually, it should be like complementary. One of the words that's really stuck out to me when we think about the field and we look forward is around, and you described it well, the word I'm using is rapport. Mm-hmm. So it's what they're very, very good at is building rapport with customers. And what we have to give them the ability to do is build rapport like across media, face-to-face and channels. And I think that that's really the trick. And it's interesting when we talk about like formats. So, you know, my partner in crime in Avast Links was Dave Witt. I absolutely guarantee you he gets a newsletter every single day, maybe two, loves them, reads them, and will continue to do that for the remainder of his career. I probably not read one for like 10 years. But that just shows you like there isn't a right answer, I don't think, around like channels and tactics. It's the key thing is having the agility and the flexibility to meet the very different needs of all customers. And that's what we need to really deliver. The other thing that's, I think, has been interesting around the pandemic, and I just want to share with you another idea that I think is, you know, now a possibility because of what's taken place. And let's say we've got a customer, and we keep talking about psoriasis, so let's keep going. We've got a customer, and they've got a concern around tolerability. And the account manager rep, whatever new name you wanted to come up with, goes and sees them to talk about their concern in tolerability. And he does an okay job. What about if there was a rep on another side of the country who was better on that particular subject? What I find really interesting now is we have this ability, like, again, the roof's kind of been blown off how we engage with customers. We're no longer limited by like a postcode or a zip code. We actually now can use data to understand who is that customer, what's their concern or, you know, their challenge, and within the field, who's the most qualified and who's got the most success in terms of tackling that. And start to instead pair people based on expertise and a particular challenge, as opposed to just on the postcode.
Yeah. And the tech's there to do it. The tech is available to do it.
Yeah, it's a mindset, though, isn't it? Yeah. It's a philosophy. Because there's lots of reasons why you would have trouble implementing that. And if the philosophy is that it's so important in the modern world that we enable that, then you come up with ways of making sure that you can do that in a as risk-free way as possible. You know, it's a philosophy.
And that's where, you know, it comes back to this thing of going, if we all agree that's a better experience, and I think it's undeniable, that's a better experience, what's going to be the catalyst that's going to drive that change if it's not now?
Yeah.
And that's not a world I particularly want to be part of. And you know what else? I don't want to be in an industry that goes through this and doesn't change.
Yeah.
You know, this is the opportunity now. You know, we didn't change as much as we should when iPads hit. We didn't change as much as we should with closed marketing, CLM, CRM. Like, if we don't change now, then, you know, at that point, you know, I do something else.
It's funny because obviously, it's all now put in the context of COVID, but before the pandemic, you know, I remember having a discussion with a very, very senior pharma person. Obviously, I won't name because of the, you know, C-suite level. And there's no way that if you started from a blank piece of paper that you would launch and manage a medicine in the way it's communicated, the way it's marketed, the way patients are supported, in the way it currently is, if you could literally design it fresh now without any of the kind of the historical baggage, should we say, of what, you know, people say has to happen in order for that to happen. And to your point about being lazy, I do not mean we wouldn't have a sales force, which is the usual stuff that people go on about, or, you know, we wouldn't do this, that, the other. Actually, a lot of it is that we first of all, it'd be much more collaborative. First of all, you know, the actual design and launch process would be more collaborative. Everything about it also would be around about that open communication to improve the patient outcome and patient experience. And actually, we've seen a bit of that with COVID in the way that people have spoken more openly about working together and about where regulatory and governments have had a more transparent relationship with, you know, but I suppose my thinking is, and their thinking was, that actually, to your point, Dave, if we're starting from scratch, and, you know, we'd not done anything like this before, you would instantly think that would be the best way to do it. But the right person to answer the right question, you know, in the most effective way, that would be obvious. you'd also, you know, yeah, I mean, I suppose you get my point, I don't need to labour it, that there's a lot of things that we do that actually are because of things that we have done in the past. But those things aren't necessarily successful. So, you know, you take Congress, you know, the massive amount of money that's spent on Congress is because that's what we have to do. You can see when it goes to virtual Congress that the things that, you know, surprise, surprise, you know, we provided for healthcare professionals, they're not too bothered about particularly. They go to the stand to charge up their phones, chat to people, to meet people, might get a bit of information that's useful to them, you know, but the point is, that's not why they go to ASCO or whatever it is. You know, what they want from pharma is something very different to just a flashy stand and some marketing materials. And actually, it's how you read, and again, even with virtual meetings, which we've spoken about on this pod during this time, it's not even the technology of, oh, we've got this platform that you can house a virtual stand and this. It's about what is the value of actually your interchange with a healthcare professional at a Congress.
One of the things I think is brilliant when it comes to Congresses is you no longer can just buy the biggest stand in the best place. Like, I literally love this concept that suddenly, like, it's now simply down to creativity. It really is. It's down to creativity. It's down to care. It's down to attention to detail. Yeah. And so I was fortunate enough to study a few years ago in San Francisco, and I had this graphics teacher, Bobby Long, she was called. And I remember her setting me this project. It was to design a postal stamp. And I'm like, you know, how can I design anything on there? It's tiny. And she's like, that's the point. And it's really like resonated with me over the last couple of months when we're thinking about Congress, because when you can't buy the biggest stand in the best place, every detail really, really counts. Yeah. Doesn't matter whether it's an email, a post, a banner, a slide, everything requires that beautiful level of like craft and detail and consideration. And whoever cares the most is going to win.
Yeah. And what's the value? So often, you know, things are measured in bizarre ways that can be contorted. You know, you would measure footfall on stand and time on stand, but what's the value exchange? And if you don't know what that is, then there's something wrong, and you're probably not exchanging a value. If the value is described as we want people to read these messages and think these things, that's not going to work in a digital environment. And I would suggest it doesn't actually work if you do pay for the biggest stand with a waterfall and, you know, a rooftop coffee shop. That's great, might go there and have a coffee, but it doesn't mean, obviously I'm reinforcing your point, but Fies, have you enjoyed virtual Congress during this period?
Well, it's back to Second Life, wasn't it, for a bit? Everyone's like, give me a 3D stand. And it was literally the first few weeks, it was 3D virtual stand, and you're thinking, actually, this is wrong, but people are still trying to learn it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, nobody's come out or changed their LinkedIn bio yet to expert in virtual meetings, because they've already moved on from blockchain to AI and then to behavioral change. But you know, if someone could crack that for a lot of people, and it would make, you know, a big difference. But from my perspective, whenever speaking to people, it's like you, Dave, say that, you know, what value are you offering to people that come to this, that interact with you at this Congress? And what have you done for the rest of the Congress? You know, what do you do with regard to the broader conversation around the meeting? What valuable stuff do you share that helps people get better insight into, you know, improving their practice or improving care for patients? You know, again, I'm boring and a literally broken record, but it's the philosophy and how you articulate that philosophy through your engagement through digitally is not about the actual technology itself. I watched one webinar from an agency talking about cracking virtual meetings, which I turned off after 10 minutes, because it was literally talking about platforms for hosting meetings, and it was just mind-numbing. I don't know why anyone would. That, if people think that's the challenge, then, you know, they're crazy.
And this is probably my biggest frustration in the industry, actually, is technology, like, winning the conversation. So. You know, if someone was to say to me, why didn't we get the power out of, say, iPads or closing marketing, is because technology won the conversation as opposed to experience. Yeah. And, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we've done well to not talk about it, But when you talk about telehealth, the first question is, do you have a platform? And I'm walking away going, I've never built a hospital in my career. I'm not, why would I be doing this? Where is going? You know, there are people who are fantastic at it. Let us, you know, provide the support and the behavior change and the content and the assets, and we'll make it the best experience it can, because people who are good at technology are good at technology. And then you need creative people who can go, right, and now we're going to like maximize how we use this.
Yeah.
And flip wise, people who are quite creative are very, very bad at technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes both parts.
Totally.
Yeah. 100%. Dave, you know, thanks so much for spending your time with us. It's been a wide ranging conversation, which I think we expected, but I personally really enjoyed it and really appreciate your thoughts and insights. So thank you very much. And the best of luck, not that you'll need it, in California. So thank you very much for coming on. And for those listening, thank you very much for listening to us. If you'd like to reach out to us, you know where to find us on the usual social platforms. And we really appreciate you listening. So Fais, thank you very much.
No, thanks a lot. It's been really good.
Thanks, Dave. Really appreciate it.
No, great. Always love your podcast. So love to be part of it. And keep doing what you're doing. Thanks.